Schools. It is May 23rd. Ms. Harris, you want to tell us a little bit about the two measures we have before us? And I also know that similar measures are approaching the House floor, and it will be voted on in the next few days. So this is a very pertinent matter. Take it away.
Thank you, Madam Chair, member of the committee. SJR 32 and SJR 33 are companion bills. Both propose amendments to the Oregon Constitution that would establish a panel of special masters to create redistricting plans every 10 years following the federal census. SJR 32 governs reapportionment for state legislative districts, and SJR 33 governs reapportionment for U.S. congressional districts.
Great, thank you. We are going to, we've got a number of folks testifying today, but we...
Pickerman, Roblin.
Hello? I don't know what I booked up.
Okay, all right. Ending right now, I think.
Great. Sorry.
This is a tough one.
I forgot. I can dial the phone, but I forget they're all on the same line.
Something you for it? Huh? In your forum?
Was Bradbury not here to testify? Well, these mics are hot.
Man has the bells, right?
Yes.
Thanks. Thank you for coming.
Well, this is Tom Mann.
Hi, Mr. Mann. This is State Senator Kate Brown. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I have a panel of legislators, Senator Atkinson, Senators Ringo, Senator Shields, and myself, and you are on speakerphone in front of a handful of witnesses, but your testimony is being channeled all throughout the Oregon Capitol building, so I just wanted to warn you of that.
I hope the Capitol survives.
Me too. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself, just for the record?
Sure. My name is Thomas Mann. I'm a senior fellow here at the Brookings Institution. I've been here since 1987. I directed the Governmental Studies Program for 12 years until 1999. Before that, I was the executive director of the American Political Science Association. I'm a political scientist who studies American politics, elections, campaign finance, election reform, and redistricting.
Great, which is the topic that we would like you to talk a little bit about. Do you have both Senate Joint Resolutions 32 and Senate Joint Resolutions 33?
Yes, I do.
And I'm going to officially open a public hearing on the two of those now that we have a quorum. Could you tell us a little bit about what you see happening across the country in terms of trends, in terms of redistricting?
Yes. There has been a good deal of attention given over the last year to redistricting processes and redistricting reform. It's partly a consequence of the declining competitiveness of congressional and state legislative elections, partly the growing ideological polarization between the parties at the national and state and local level, and partly I think it's the active intervention of national party officials in the redistricting process in an effort to try to move one party or the other off this position of near parity. So that, I think that's the context in which a lot of attention has been paid. I think another part of this is that many people interested in reform had looked to the courts. But now the courts once again have weighed in with a decision in Veith, which dealt with a partisan gerrymander in Pennsylvania. And while the court allowed the possibility of a gerrymander being declared unconstitutional, it couldn't imagine a set of standards to be used in determining that it was. So the general feeling around the country now is that the courts are unlikely to be the driver of change in redistricting, and if it happens, it's It's going to happen in the states. Now, there are about 20 states that that have introduced legislation. There are a half dozen states considering citizen-initiated propositions through the initiative process to change the redistricting process. Some states are looking at fairly minor things like changing the standards for redistricting in their constitutions or statutes, but most are looking at alternative processes. I'd say the overwhelming focus of the reform efforts now around the country are to move from the normal legislative process with the two legislative bodies writing a redistricting plan that has to be signed by the governor to independent redistricting commissions. Now, there exist six states that give to such independent commissions the first and final authority for drawing congressional district lines, and 11 states where that authority is given for drawing state legislative lines. A number of other states have commissions as backups if the legislative process fails to produce a plan. And then we have the anomaly of Iowa, which is often thought of as a commission state, but really is not. It's a state in which a state legislative agency is delegated the task of drawing up plans under very restrictive standards, but the state legislature then has three opportunities to either amend that plan in some minor way or to replace it wholesale. What's happening around the states. I'd say sort of final point on this is that when it comes to the commissions, there's tremendous variability in how they're structured, their size, whether they have even or odd numbers, the pool of potential members, how they're appointed, whether there's a majority or supermajority rule for approving a plan, and there are different consequences, likely consequences, depending on how those commissions are structured. Lots of questions about whether it's going to produce a partisan plan or a bipartisan incumbent protection plan, and much difference over how best to achieve competitiveness and partisan fairness. Some states think the way to achieve it is to require those outcomes, that is to build into the standards competitive districts and partisan fairness. Other states believe the way to do it is to constrain the process, keep certain information away from those drawing the lines, and that will produce the desired outcomes. Why don't I end there, as hopefully that provides you with an overview.
Mr. Mann, when you say constrain the process, I assume information like political party registration, et cetera, out of the hands of those doing the redistricting?
Exactly. Where the residents of the incumbent member or other candidates, any party registration or past voting patterns. It might also constrain it by the commission by requiring that one achieve, as in the case of your bill, the lowest possible number of divisions of civil jurisdictions, whether they be counties or cities, and the smallest number of fragments from that process. So some, as in the Oregon bill that I've seen, would work entirely through constraining the process. Others, say Arizona, believe it's important to build as a standard into the process something pertaining to competitiveness. In the case of Washington, and I understand you have, you'll be talking to someone from the Washington Commission, they build in both partisan fairness and competitiveness into their process.
Okay, thank you. Can you tell us a little bit more about Iowa? Have they had their process for a long period of time, or is this something new?
Yeah, Iowa has had this underway for a number of decades. You know, Iowa's an unusual state, but maybe Oregon thinks of itself as similar in some respects. It's a relatively small state. It has a very small number of minorities. Its counties are structured in a compact fashion. It has a strong progressive tradition of non-partisanship. And the process itself is one in which the redistrictors are blind to both incumbency and party. That is to say, they allow no such information to be utilized, and they direct the staff drawing up these new lines to pay attention to the more standard redistricting criteria, that is population equality, contiguity, unity of counties and cities, and compactness. But then their plan needs to go to the legislature for approval and then signed into law by the governor. So this is not a process independent of the normal legislative process that is protected in the Constitution. Instead, you could argue it's an advisory process to the normal legislative process. The difference is the norms in Iowa have been so strong in favor of this nonpartisan process that the legislature has been reluctant to override the state agency submitting the plans, although it bears noting that in 1981, when Republican leaders complained that two of their House incumbents were thrown together in a Democratic-leaning district, these problems were ameliorated in the second and ultimately successful third plan. So there's some level of negotiation that occurs between the staff agency and the legislature, but for the most part, the state legislative plans and the congressional plans drawn up by the staff agency have been, for the most part, accepted by the legislature.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mann. Let me check and see if there's any questions from the panel. Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Mr. Mann, for that information. I come at this issue without having spent much time looking at the redistricting issue in general, but I have a couple questions. One of them is the resolution we're looking at, SJR 32, appoints judges as special masters, retired judges, and I guess the thought is that judges are able to rise above the fray, and I guess sometimes they do. I'm not sure that they are, you know, specially impartial people. But what's your, just a comment on that? What would you recommend that we select retired judges because we think they have some unique qualifications?
Yeah, it certainly is one of the ideas out there. California is the other state that is considering judges as special masters. I mean, one of the problems, of course, is that our judges, many states, our judges are now elected, and and elections has become very intense and very partisan with outside groups intervening, very ideological, and so in some states the pool of judges produces a group of fairly partisan people, while others less so. I'm just not sure what the experience is in Oregon, but I would say one of the risks that you take on here is by having an odd number of special masters, in this case three, all of whom are selected at lot after this nominating process and in preemption of certain members. The only thing you guarantee is that there'll be one Republican and one Democrat, but what you're likely to end up with is two members with a background in one party and one in the other. And some of the other states that have moved in this direction have tried to deal with this by actually having equal numbers selected with backgrounds, although not having involvement in the two parties, either one or two or three or more, but then a sort of tie-breaking member appointed in a way that allows the members initially selected to agree upon that tie-breaking member so that you don't build in a partisan majority at the outset. Now, this legislation deals with that in part by requiring a unanimity among the three members of the redistricting plan. One of the problems with unanimity in these situations is that it tends to encourage incumbent protection, what we call sort of bipartisan plans, because everyone has to sign off. Now, you've worked against this by denying certain information to the commission, but it does strike one looking at it from outside as a little unusual to go through such an elaborate process for nominating and selecting members of this panel, then to almost guarantee that it'll be 2-1 leading in one party or the other. Set up a rule of unanimity and denying them information so it doesn't matter after all.
Mr. Mann, can I break in with a question?
Sure.
I'm just looking at this resolution for the first time, and I may be missing something. I appreciate a comment from the staff. I see that there are 24 special masters. Are there three?
That's
the initial pool.
I see. And then from that initial pool, three are selected.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. A follow-up question I had, and this is my lack of knowledge on the redistricting process, but in section 6A of the resolution, it lists in order the priority on what criteria are used. For example, the first one is the highest possible number of counties undivided by district boundaries. Are those priorities given actual literal interpretation, so that if a plan was produced that didn't comply with that would be automatically rejected?
That is an excellent question, because one of the things I noticed here is that very language running the risk of providing the basis for a court challenge. If someone could demonstrate that there was another plan that that actually left one more county undivided, even if it may have suffered on some other ground. So there's something to be said for substituting language such as greatest extent practicable for highest possible number. But you're going to find inevitable, unless you want this to be a purely mechanical process, and that may become problematic if the Voting Rights Act ends up applying in some respects. It may become problematic in achieving equal population districts.
Mr. Mann, if I could ask you another question, please. You had mentioned that in some states they provide information to the decision makers, and in some states they intentionally don't. And my question is, what do you recommend?
You have to decide what's really most important to you. There have been times when Iowa's blind process has produced outcomes that were not, quote, fair between the parties, which lumped several incumbents together in a district. And the question is that a good thing? That is the purity of the process what's important, or the nature of the outcome? What are the highest priorities that you have? Some states like New Jersey believe that some degree of incumbent protection is a good thing because it helps the state in Washington. This is for congressional redistricting. New Jersey also happens to believe the highest priority is to keep a majority party from establishing a partisan gerrymander and taking unfairly frustrating the will of voters in the way they draw the lines.
Mr. Mann, I want to ask you what you just said about New Jersey wanting to favor their clout in Washington. Tell me how they do that.
Their incumbents, you mean?
Yeah, their incumbents.
They
want to retain incumbency to retain power.
In their case, what they do is they have a tie-breaking member, but he has to choose between the plans submitted by the Democratic and Republican members on the commission, and for the congressional districts, what they will oftentimes do is come up with a bipartisan plan that protects most of their incumbents, and therefore the tiebreaker doesn't have really any real choice.
And we're speaking, Senator Ringo, to Mr. Giese later on this afternoon, so he can give us a little bit more detailed information. Mr. Mann, a couple quick questions. Nebraska, what kind of redistricting process do they have? Are you familiar with that?
Which state was that?
Nebraska. If you don't, it's okay. I'm just curious.
I don't. Of course, they have a unicameral legislature, which makes it unusual. My little chart here shows that they use the for both congressional and legislative, they use the normal legislative process, which is the unicameral and the governor's signature or veto, and it's produced a fairly standard process and outcome.
Okay, thank you. Questions, other questions for the committee? Thank you very much. We really appreciate your willingness to participate, and we're going to set you free and let you go home for the evening.
Well, thanks. I enjoyed it. I wish you all very well.
Thank you. Mr. Gans, you're up next.
6:30 p.m. his time.
Yes. I'm sure it's only just beginning back east, but...
It's also my time.
You're doing good so far.
Well, I don't go to bed at 6:30. I want to tell you what a joy it is to walk into a government building and not have metal detectors. You take off your shoes or empty your pockets. It's a wonderful thing. It's also a wonderful thing to see your typical weather with blue skies and dry conditions.
You missed the entire 6 weeks of rain before this, that it rained 1 inch every single day. So.
Yeah, I'm sharing. It's so nice that our guest can be here for summer.
One day of it.
My name is Curtis Gans, and I'm the director of what has been the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate, which was, and you know, legally until about 2 months ago, and physically still is, a nonpartisan, independent research organization looking into questions of voter participation. I'm about to move to American University, and it'll be the center rather than, you know, the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate. I'm here rather than talking on the phone because I consider this issue probably one of the two most important procedural issues that, you know, this country faces for the health of its democracy. And thanks to Perrin Airways, I was able to get here. The problem we face is essentially has been exacerbated by technology. We've always had gerrymandering of districts. What we can do right now is pinpoint the populations in such a way as to be absolutely sure of how we gerrymander. And what we do in states in which one party controls the legislature and the other and the governorship is gerrymander for that party, in which they put almost everybody who is a member of the opposition party into the fewest number of districts, you know, and reserve the rest of the districts for themselves. And where you have divided authority, people run scared, and therefore they protect the maximum number of, you know, incumbents. But what that has led to is a gradual decline in competitive districts for both Congress and state legislature. 10 years ago, we probably had 75 to 100 districts that were competitive for Congress. This last election, there were less than 40 that were decided 55 to 45 or less. Where you are with this is that you make, because there are one-party districts, you make the relevant election not the general election, but the primary. If you win the primary, you're elected. The average turnout for a statewide primary for the Democrats, and that's governor or senator, is 10% of eligibles. The average turnout for a Republican primary is 8% of the eligibles. Congressional turnout is less, and state legislature is less than that. And that essentially means that an organized minority of 3 or 4% of the electorate can propel a candidate to victory in the primary and therefore to election. And that essentially, the organized minorities probably in both political parties, you know, now, you know, more clearly in the Republican Party, are at the extremes. And if you want to explain why our politics is polarized, why we have declining civility, why peripheral issues rise to the top of the agenda, why we have gridlock, I think you can start with those two things, the way we draw districts and the low turnout.
And the what was the second one?
Low turnout.
Low turnout. Thank you.
The other thing is that the leadership stream, those who go to higher office, tend to come from those people who get elected, you know, in lower offices. And so essentially, you can see it in progression. The state legislature started getting most polarized, then came Congress, and now we're, you know, at the level of the United States Senate. I don't want to argue for any particular plan, but I think you have to get it out of the realm of partisanship. As far as I'm concerned, any plan that enables people to have a standard of compactness, contiguousness, and competitiveness where possible, not always possible. You could draw as many legislative districts in Harlem and you would never get competitiveness. Probably the same thing is true in Orange County. To me, the critical issue is what plan can you adopt that both parties will buy into and that is likely to prove durable. It doesn't matter to me. But it does matter to me that we change the character of American politics and that we allow ourselves to recreate a political and constructive middle in this country. And we won't do that unless we change the way we draw districts. And I want to say one last thing, which is the Senate passed a bill for nonpartisan elections of statewide office and perhaps state legislative office. That is the wrong way to go. This is the right way to go. That is the wrong way to go because parties are important in our society.
Mr. Ganz, I'm glad you brought that up because I was actually going to ask you about it. Why do you think parties are important, and why do you think that parties don't contribute, that they in themselves do not contribute to the partisanship?
Well, parties do contribute to the partisanship.
Okay.
Partisanship right now has a bad name because the more extreme elements control both parties, and therefore you have intransigence. But constructive partisanship has always been a good thing. A party, in its best role, separates the wheat from the chaff of interest group advocacy and picks the important things. It trains and educates leadership. It aggregates, money and organization for mobilization and involving the people. It has the ability to, exercise some discipline when people are elected. It draws the lines of debate, and we would sacrifice all of that were we, to move, to essentially a nonpartisan, set of elections.
You said earlier that you thought the way we draw districts and voter turnout has increased polarization. Could you comment a little further on that?
Well, if we draw partisan districts, in which essentially there is no competition, in the general election in that district, the only thing that's relevant is the primary. And when turnout in the primary, is 7% or 6%, then it essentially what you are empowering is organized minorities to dominate our politics. 3% or 3.5% or 4% can win that primary. And the organized minorities tend to be the people who are most zealous on both sides. And so essentially what you do is empower the people at the extremes at the expense of the middle.
In terms of redistricting plans across the nation, I heard your comments earlier that you're not supporting any particular approach. Are there some ingredients or principles that get us to the criteria that you use, compactness, competitiveness, and contiguousness?
Well, I mean, those are the principles. I tend to favor, not constraining information, but having information, so that you can arrive at those, conclusions. But who should do it? To my mind is whatever you in Oregon can agree on as to who should do it and under what process.
Okay. Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Ringo.
Thank you for coming to Oregon, Mr. Ganz. I met you in Hawaii in December. And
it's always a good place to meet.
And appreciated meeting you then. It's good to see you now.
That's where I met Senator Brown.
Right. I heard this statistic, and I don't remember the numbers, but essentially it made the point that when it comes to racial diversity, our country is becoming more diverse. It's more likely than it was 10 or 20 years ago to have somebody of a different ethnic background living next to you. When it comes to political diversity, we're moving in the opposite direction. And there's some statistic about if you have the chance of a neighbor being of the opposite political party has diminished a lot in the last 10 or 20 years. My wife told me this story the other day. She met somebody who moved to Oregon from someplace in the Midwest just because she couldn't stand the political climate there. That's the sole reason this family, this little small business owner, moved to Portland. And one of the things that I haven't heard you touch upon is this how we're segregating ourselves in terms of our political beliefs.
Well, we are to some extent. I mean, Oregon is not necessarily the place, which you would hold up as a model of, segregated political belief.
Downtown Portland?
There is some of that. I have to say, which I wrote somebody an email today. He wrote me an email about how he had been born 25 miles from Salem, and I said, the only other place I've ever considered living other than where I am now living is Eugene. Uh-huh. And I think this state is a wonderful state. The answer is that's true, although in my block, where I live in rural Virginia, my almost next door neighbor has a totally diametrical viewpoint, but people tend to to move to places where you have a degree of homogeneity.
But it's a change we've seen in the 20 years. If you look at the red blue map,
I don't believe the red blue map.
But look at it on a county-by-county basis. It used to be that there were red and blue counties in the Midwest, all interspersed.
I believe that there is some truth to what Alan Wolfe wrote, which is, One America After All. That there are a whole series of beliefs that, most Americans share. And that we have been forced into a polarized politics that has given this red blue.
That's right.
But I think this is a step, what you're considering, to rekindling a politics of shared values rather than divided values. And I think that's a very important thing to do. We are going to have Latinos living with Latinos, Chinese living with Chinese, African Americans living with Chinese, but we can break down some of those barriers if we work at it. And one of the ways to work at it is to get leadership on both sides of the fence that is less intransigent.
Madam Chair, maybe we can have school busing programs so that liberals and...
No, I don't want school, but I was deeply involved in the civil rights movement, and one of the greatest mistakes the liberals ever engaged in was the bus.
Yeah.
School buses, the way to integrate.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions? Sarah Ferrioli.
I was thinking of my good colleague from the metropolitan area talked about the red-blue map. There's a lot of ways to look at it. Multnomah County, I think, has a significant voter registration edge toward the Democrat column. I think the same is true of King County. I think the same may be true of other counties, but in any case, in many of the western states, you've got a significant urban area. And it is the major population center, Boise, Idaho, Ada County. I don't know.
I think you're going to make it very hard to think that Boise, Idaho is a, you know, is a hotbed of Democratic partisanship.
No, I think they don't have a...
Well, no, I think it is beginning to be, yes.
I don't know if they even have any Democrats in the legislature.
They do out of Boise.
Two or three maybe out of the whole number. But the point I'm trying to make here is that maybe the red-blue map is not the proper idiom, but there certainly is an urban-rural divide in this country that's well-documented. And there certainly is, I think... you touched on it. People tend to congregate in homogeneous communities, and often those communities are very out of step with surrounding communities, and that's certainly what we see in Oregon. A major population area, major center of commerce, major center of learning and culture, major transportation network, and the votes in those communities and the political power in those communities are concentrated. And redistricting or districting reflects that, but it also gives folks from that majority a lock on the statewide and the legislative races. And I'm wondering if there's something in districting that could help reopen that mixture to reach out to people that now feel disenfranchised.
Well, two things. You know, first is, you know, Portland may be a major transportation center, but it's also a center of gridlock, as far as I'm concerned, on rush hour.
Because they won't build roads.
I don't want to, you know, that's not my area of expertise, and I don't want to get into it. The answer is you can do it on fringes of, you know, these, you know, population center. You know, as I said, you're not going to change Harlem, you're not going to change Orange County. There are going to be places, you know, whose core are so one side or the other that you can't do anything about it. But on the edges, you can. When I said competitiveness, you know, where possible, you know, you have to figure out where possible. And I think there are clearly places here that are possible. There are probably many more places here that are possible on the state legislative level, than there are, you know, in terms of the current representation.
Senator Ferriello, I guess what I thought you said is that the failure of one party to be competitive at a statewide level is due to redistricting that doesn't sort of weave districts from urban into suburban into rural areas, and I guess...
Was that what you were talking about on the statewide level, or were you talking about on the statewide level in the legislature?
I think we have about three different conversations. The question I'm interested in is that there seems to be a number of states in the West that there's a concentrated political power and a population base. And that tends to fall into the red map, blue map idiom that we were talking about earlier.
It's
to be the major population
but,
base.
But Senator Ferriello, I would highly dispute that if you're looking at Oregon, since rural legislators controlled the Oregon legislature for the last decade. I mean, with all due respect.
But are you raising the question of statewide elections? Because if you're raising the question of statewide election, it is the character of the candidates that has been determinative.
Ah, you really believe that, Mr. Gans?
Absolutely. In both California and Oregon.
And in Washington too, don't you think?
Well,
I don't know yet.
I don't think that, you know, I mean, I think that's less true in Washington than it is, you know, in this state or in California.
Why do you say that, Mr. Gans?
Amongst other things, because I don't think Mr. Rossi, you know, is an extreme conservative.
Right.
You know, I think both candidates came from the middle on that. You know.
And that accounts for the closeness of the
race. Right.
Okay. Other questions, Senator Ferriello? Senator Shields?
No.
Okay.
You can get rid of me.
No, I'm kind of looking at my notes. Mr. Mann said that his criteria were a little different than yours. I think he said fairness and competitiveness. Would you agree with that? Yeah, competitiveness and fairness. Would you agree with those two criteria?
In addition to compact and contiguous.
Okay. What are the benefits of compactness and contiguousness?
That people don't suspect that lines are drawn for certain purposes.
What about making sure that at least in a state that's, like Oregon, where we don't have a very diverse population, and making sure that we have some people of color serving in the legislature, how do you address that issue? Or should it not be addressed?
I have been uncomfortable with the majority-minority districts that were created in the South. I think that's essentially part of the redistricting problem. If, for instance, on the Democratic side, Phil Burton could be so sophisticated in California that he could create a 26-seat increase. The Republicans have been doing the same thing in the South by shoving minorities into majority-minority districts. I think minorities should be competing as individuals, just as women ought to be competing as individuals, just as Puerto Ricans or Chinese or conservative Republicans or liberal Republicans. I do not think we should draw districts based on hyphenated Americans. I think we should draw districts on what's best for the for the whole.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate your testimony. Appreciate your willingness to travel this far. I hope that someone makes sure you get a good dinner tonight.
Thank you. I've got less than guaranteed.
All right. Next up. I lost Mr. Giese's phone number. There it is. Okay, 202. 206. 206. 202 is Washington.
Who is this? Yeah, I've met some of those characters.
This is Mr. Giese. He is part of Washington State's Independent Redistricting Commission.
Good afternoon. This is John Giese.
Hi, John Giese. This is Kate Brown calling from, I was going to say from Portland, but we're in Salem this afternoon. How are you?
Very good, Kate.
Good. I've got Senator Shields and Senator Farioli with me. I believe Senator Ringo will follow. You are on speakerphone. We've got a couple of handfuls of folks in the audience, and your testimony is probably being taped throughout the Capitol, so just to warn you.
That's fine.
Okay. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became a part of Washington State's Redistricting Commission?
Certainly. Again, and for the record, and I have a cold, so if you have troubles with my voice today, I'm sorry. But I'm John Giese. I'm a senior vice president with Rocky Hill and Knowlton, and I work out of their Seattle office, and Hill and Knowlton is one of the world's largest public relations firms. And I've been a public relations, public affairs consultant since 1989. Before that, I have a lot of experience of working with elected officials. I was chief of staff for a former United States congressman, worked on a governor's staff for a mayor and things like that, as well as some regulatory agencies. And it was because of that this varied experience, I think, that Clyde Ballard, who was at that time the Republican co-speaker of the House, we had a tied session of 49 Republicans and 49 Democrats, asked me to be the House Republican appointee to the Redistricting Commission.
You were lucky to get to work with Representative Ballard.
I thought so.
And so have you been on the commission since then? Has it been a continuing duty?
No.
Okay.
No. You know, maybe I'd even give you a little bit of a preference. You know, Washington State, until the early 80s, like most states, did redistricting by legislative action, at least in theory, although most of the time we ended up in court with a court master drawing the final boundaries because the process was always very contentious and often took several years. And in 1983, however, the legislature passed a constitutional amendment, and it takes 60% of both chambers of our legislature to pass a constitutional amendment, and then they put it on the ballot, and the voters passed it to create an independent bipartisan commission to do redistricting. That commission, so our, in Washington State, the legislative and congressional districts have been done by a commission for the past two decades. And I served on the commission during 2001 and 2002.
Okay.
And it,
but it's a temporary service. You won't automatically right. then go on to serve in the next redistricting time frame.
And it's, it is set up that way by the enabling legislation, too. We have basically 2 years, well, less than 2 years to complete our task.
So a couple of questions for you. We heard from Mr. Mann earlier that the sort of move toward nonpartisan redistricting commissions has really started fairly recently. So I'm curious what prompted Washington to go in this direction sort of a decade or two, actually 2 decades earlier than the rest of the country.
Well, you know, when it comes to major legislation, usually you have to have some catalytic event that kind of causes a sea change. And the process in Washington State, even though it was usually ended up being done by a court, for a long time, the Democrats could pretty much count on controlling the redistricting process in Washington State. In 1980, however, we elected a Republican governor and Republican majorities to the legislature, and the Democrats were on the receiving end of what the redistricting process was like. And it was a huge distraction during a time when the state's economy was in very tough shape. And there was just sort of a realization on both parties about how in the heck do we avoid putting the legislature through this every 10 years and the bitterness and the division it creates. And that led, and then after the 82 elections, the Democrats took back the state house, and so we had a bipartisan group that were willing to push for reform.
Okay.
But it was a realization by both parties that the process was not working very well.
And my very sort of scant understanding of the Washington Commission is that you have two members of each party and then an independent member. Is that right?
Well, that's pretty close. What the commission has five members. Each legislative caucus leader appoints one member. Ours is not a nonpartisan. Ours is very much a bipartisan redistricting commission. And then the four appointed members get together and have the legal responsibility of selecting a non-voting chair.
Ah.
So in the end, it means that Republicans and Democrats, to succeed, have to come together and support a plan.
Hmm.
Well, really two plans, one for the legislature, one for the...
Talk to me a little bit about the practicalities of staffing then. Who does the legislative staff then staff the commission?
They do, but not solely.
Okay.
We had the redistricting commission hired its own staff. We were given a budget by the legislature. Extensive legwork before our appointment had been done by the Secretary of State's office, but that was really of a technical nature in terms of, you know, the census data and that sort of information. And each legislative caucus also did have some redistricting staff who provided additional support, but we had our own central staff, and like us, they were short-term. You know, we were a temporary state agency.
What criteria is the commission required to use, if any?
Well, there's two sets of criteria. One of them is there is criteria in the statute for who can be appointed to the commission. And if, for example, you can't be an elected official, you can't be a lobbyist during the time you serve, you know, on the commission, and you can't have been one for a couple of years or something like that. I can't remember exactly, but those are all in both the Constitution and in the enabling legislation. And then there are criteria for drawing the legislative districts. And the criteria aren't prioritized, and it sounds like maybe people are writing some of this down. If you go to the Washington State Secretary of State's website, there's a link for redistricting, and part of our old website is still there, and it spells out some of these criteria.
Okay.
But they're in the statute, too, and there are things like each district shall have a population as nearly equal as practicable. Districts are to consider communities of interest and political boundaries of local jurisdictions. Districts should be convenient, contiguous, and compact. Plans should be fair and encourage electoral competition. And the plans should not purposely favor or discriminate against any particular group. So those are spelled out, but as you can see, you know, there's some contradiction in those things, and it's left up to the commission members to resolve apparent contradictions in the criteria.
Mr. Giese, I'm curious. One of the theories that's been laid out about bipartisan redistricting or nonpartisan redistricting is that it will sort of decrease polarization in the legislative process and in the congressional delegation. Any comments as to what kind of impact that's had on Washington State in terms of your legislative process?
I would, you know, we've only done this twice. I was a close observer the first time, then a participant the second. And my observations are that it did exactly that in these two instances. The legislature knew that they were being listened to, that they had a voice, but that they did not control this process. It was very much transparent and in the public's eye. And so the kind of legislative leadership can't go to any individual member and say, if you don't vote for A and B, we'll remember it when we're drawing your district boundaries. I mean, that it's totally removed, and just kind of the conflicts that go on over the whole process of redistricting was eliminated. That didn't mean that some legislators, you know, sometimes you can kind of tell geographically where your district has to go, and so some of them might have started to speak in areas outside the boundary, assuming that they might end up representing those communities. But the impact was just almost totally eliminated.
Some of the polarization?
Yeah. From this. Other issues still come.
Got it. Okay. All right. Sort of my next question. My recollection is that in terms of, well, particularly the House, but the Senate as well, has really, over the last decade, has really gone back and forth. I know the House was split for three very long years, but is it fair to say that there's been pretty consistent changeover in terms of leadership in the legislature?
Yes, in the past, I'm not even always sure if that's a good thing, but we definitely have had several changes in legislative leadership.
And one last question, the sort of two and two with one in the middle, and that one in the middle is non-voting, doesn't that in effect have the impact of protecting incumbents?
You know, we spent a lot of time, as you would imagine, talking about that question. And we didn't see it as our job to unelect people who had been elected. And we had taken the time, you know, to seek civic service and their constituents saw fit to elect them. I mean, that doesn't mean we were trying to protect incumbents either, but if you would look at Washington State, we've had a lot of turnover. And so I think, and turnover happens for a bunch of reasons, as everybody on this call knows. There's never a single factor. But you can't look to districts in our state and say that because of redistricting, we've had very stable elected officials or incumbents. That's simply not the case.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a tendency redistricting, as we all know, is about redistributing political power. And part of the problem with a lot of the current processes is it is done, it's so often a winner-take-all process. And the result of that is the loser takes the winner to court to see if they can get a better solution. And frequently they do, or in some states, there are states around the country where they spend the entire decade in one court process after another and have new districts every few years, especially on some of the congressional districts. That really does not serve the public well at all. And our process that is used in the state ends up with the major political participants basically saying, whether I like this or not, I know I can't go to court and get a better deal. And that gives the commission some real strength. I mean, our plans in the end have to be approved by the legislature. However, they can't change any more than 2% of any one district, and they need a two-thirds vote to do that.
Wow.
The governor doesn't sign the bill. It's just done by the two chambers. So I believe that trying to pretend that redistricting is a nonpartisan process, or that you can find retired judges or people who haven't been all that active in politics and ask them to go out and draw lines.
What you're saying is it's truly a partisan process. Let's make it a fair one.
Yes, and it is one of the... That's I would summarize it that way. I think that's fair. Yeah.
I didn't want to put words in your mouth.
No, I think that's... I would agree with that statement.
Okay. Sarah Ferry.
That doesn't mean it's easy, however. Once again, you know, we're like... we were like four legislators with a staff who had to come to an agreement on a very difficult, two difficult bills. If we failed, our failure was going to be very public. We had no long-term interest in this, in the sense, I mean, our little per diem check goes away once it's done. It's very, you know, it's still really difficult to draw these lines, and we've succeeded twice. But I don't want to imply that it's an easy process. It is still, you know, a very difficult thing to accomplish.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. Any questions?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I really appreciated the concept, learning the concept that's been working in Washington State. I also appreciated the concept that, at least in some cases, winner-take-all is the rule rather than the exception. And the idea that redistricting redistributes political power, I think if we can look at the last two cycles and just think about what people were saying on both sides of the aisle about the Kiesling redistribution, for redistricting plan and the outcomes of that. I've heard bitter complaints from Democrat elected officials that the Kiesling redistricting plan put them at a systemic disadvantage, and that may be just subjective. Matter of fact, it almost certainly is subjective. I've heard the same criticisms about the Bradbury redistricting plan, that it certainly did disempower or disenfranchise Republicans. I've lived with caucus members whose districts were lost to them, or they had to move to run for election, and I know that causes really long-term bad feelings about the process. And I was interested in the Washington case about the 2% limitation. So, you know, I think there's a lot in the Washington plan that bears some further study.
If I may, there's one other thing that I really believe is very important that we really didn't discuss, and that's just about having a process that's transparent to the public. Our commission meetings were open to the public. We held 16 hearings around the state. Mm. People, it was easy for them to submit plans and comments. As individual commissioners had plans, we all made plans, recommendations that, to each other that were public and that people could look at and, you know, and comment on. And I think that helped a lot, too.
Thank you. Any other questions, Mr. Ferriola?
Fascinating testimony.
Mr. Giese, we really appreciated your testimony, your time and energy today. We wish you the best in your political, political consulting, but PR, you said PR, right?
Yeah, I don't do political consulting. I've worked on campaigns as a volunteer and years ago, but and that experience was invaluable, but no, I'm not a campaign consultant.
PR work.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Thank you very much for your time.
Glad to have been of any help or service.
And we may
good
be
luck in with your task.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Next up, Ms. Eaton, Mr. Turrell, and Ms. Miller. Why don't you come on up? You don't want to? Okay, I'm sorry. I thought you'd asked earlier. Okay. That's fine. Sure. David, Mr. Buchanan.
Why don't you go first, and then I can clean up.
Okay. Where are we? Aren't you with the League of Women Voters, too? Okay. You're changing hats.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
I'll see if I can clear that up.
Okay.
Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli. For the record, my name is Andy Miller. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Oregon. I will not bore you with reading this. David, would you give this to them? This is Common Cause has redistricting as a national priority, and so we have established a set of guidelines that are very similar to what you've heard today. The creation of a nonpartisan redistricting commissions, the fair criteria for congressional legislative districts, they shall be composed of equal populations, comply with the United States Constitution and the Voting Rights Act, district boundaries shall represent communities of interest to the extent practicable. Districts shall be geographically compact and contiguous. Competitive districts shall be favored. And there's a footnote on that, and that is because that's a very hard thing to determine what a competitive is. But you heard the importance about being incumbent blind, and I know that in the House side, when HDR 39, which did pass the House last week, so it's they were very concerned with starting from scratch, as they called it, so that incumbent blind. A very important part is the public participation and transparency. The frequency would be just do it on the year ending with one, and don't be having it go back and forth in the courts, and judicial review. I have asked David Buchanan to come forward with me because David is very knowledgeable about the history of the process in Oregon. He's written a book called The Almanac of Oregon Politics, and I think he can really answer questions you might have.
Well, let me just make a couple of quick points, and that is that there are a couple of factors that I haven't heard discussed that might be added to the mixture. One of them is in the membership of the commission, a five-member commission drawn from retired judges is okay, but I think that you might consider expanding that, maybe have a seven-member commission and designating that one has expertise in mathematics and one has expertise in geography to help give the panel a little bit wider perspective on some of the technical issues that they'll be having to deal with. One other factor that hasn't been talked about that was a factor back in some of the early redistrictings in the earlier era in Oregon when it was done kind of by hand. One of the goals was to try and have the least disruption possible. For instance, if there's a district that under the new population is deficient by 5,000 people, the least disruptive would be to add 5,000. One other way to meet equality is to subtract 5,000 from one side of the district and add 10,000 to the other side. That disrupts a lot more constituents, so to have that idea factored in to make it lesser rather than greater disruption to the number of people involved is another factor that might be added into the mixture. Thank you.
Madam Chair and member of the committee, my name is Norman Turrell. I'm a state board member of Common Cause and am today speaking only on behalf of Common Cause. You have seen me before representing the League of Women Voters, and I want to emphasize I'm not representing anything that the League might say on this subject. I would point out that just yesterday at the League State Convention we passed a study on redistricting, which unfortunately it's not available yet, but if you want to wait for another session of the legislature, we can then have a study available for being able to comment on this process. But there's a few points that I'd like to make. First of all, I want to relate a little of my own personal background. In the early 1980s, I lived in Washington State and was a volunteer lobbyist on behalf of Common Cause on the subject of redistricting commission. And I wanted to balance a bit of what Mr. Giese had to say. One thing I don't think he really brought out was the fact that the commission members, the four of them, are appointed by the leaders of the four caucuses of the legislature. And as such, they tend to be highly political people, even though there's some rules about how you can you can't appoint lobbyists, for example. But they still tend to be highly partisan people who are involved in the commission. And as a result of this, the commission, the way it votes, has to have at least three votes for any redistricting plan. And so it tends to come out with a plan that is a bipartisan gerrymander. And by this I mean a plan that has the maximum number of safe districts. They tend to trade safe districts between them. You create a safe district over here and I'll create another one over here for us. And so the voters lose in that process. And I want to tell you that even though I advocated that plan in the early 80s, I now regret it, or at least to the extent that we, in hindsight, we could have done a lot better job by it removing the process even further from the politics of the situation, if possible. So I'd like to recommend you that you, if possible, come out with a commission that is at least as much apolitical as possible, not necessarily a nonpartisan, but removed from the partisan considerations as much as possible. And that way, the voters will win in the process. The objective, in my mind, should be to make the maximum number of swing districts, if possible, and that's not possible in every part of the state, certainly, but the voters then could hold their public officials accountable more often than they are in Washington State at this time.
Mr. Turrell, I'm sorry, your name in my brain is, it phonetically looks the other way around, so I keep wrestling with it. You heard my question, I believe, to Mr. Giese about the fact that, you know, the Washington legislature, for all intents and purposes, has really gone back and forth quite frequently. Since in the last 6 years, I believe, the House was in tied control, and now it's in Democratic control. The Senate in the last 4 years has switched, I believe, twice. I mean,
you have to also know they have term limits in Washington State, and so that there is a lot of turnover. And also loss of institutional memory in the process.
Are you sure? Yes.
Yes.
Sure. On term limits?
Yes. As I remember, they passed it in the 1990s.
Okay.
There's one other factor in Washington State that if you look at the congressional districts where there is no term limits, there has been a considerable number of party changing hands of mm-hmm. districts, and sometimes there have been five or six switches of party in the congressional districts. I think that if you looked at that, you would see an example without the term limits, and they've still had considerable party switching of the congressional districts in Washington State.
Mm-hmm. So you're agreeing, at least with the analysis, that the districts, if even if being drawn by a partisan commission, a bipartisan commission, at least the districts are competitive, correct?
Yes, and I think that the competitiveness of Washington State's congressional districts is fairly remarkable, much higher than most states.
Yeah, I think I'll agree to the extent that the larger the district is, the more diversity you're going to have in the district. It's in the legislative districts, then, since they're very small, tend to be less diverse and harder to also draw in a competitive manner, and that's where you get into trouble. And so one way out of this would be to consider other ways of voting, so that if you had multi-member districts, for example, that would ease the importance of the district lines. And if you did away with district lines altogether and had some way of, I'm not advocating this.
You're like really into chaos theory, aren't you?
I'm not advocating this, but I'm saying that at the other extreme is if you got rid of all district lines and elected by a proportional representation system, for example, you wouldn't have any problem with the districts. And there's, of course, ways of voting in between where...
It's used in Australia,
yeah.
As I recall.
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm not advocating any particular way of approaching that, but the idea is that if you make it larger districts, then they become more diverse and less prone to partisanship.
And Mr. Turrell, the reason I'm questioning the term limits in Washington is that I know Representative Ballard, who was Speaker of the House, retired after 12 years. I know that my...
It's 12 years.
12 years totally. Yeah. Okay. All right. That might make some sense then. Okay. Sarah Ferriero, you had some questions, but he left. So
there's
want to talk?
Oregon had a short experience in multi-member districts in the 60s. In Oregon's translation before single-member districts, which came in 1972, the one county that was large enough that was split into sub-districts and multi-member sub-districts, and Portland had four sub-districts, one with three members, or three with three members and one with four members. The voting pattern in those sub-districts was that each of the sub-districts invariably elected all of the members of the same party, with one exception where most of them were all Democrats, but one was all Republicans. And I think in the time when they had the multi-member districts, there was one instance when the sub-district elected members of different parties in the same sub-district. But normal procedure was that the voters elected all members of the same party in a sub-district.
It was the goal of the National Women's Political Caucus to have gender equity in state legislatures by the year 2000. We are substantially short of that goal 4 years later. Talk to me about how a nonpartisan redistricting will help women and people of color diversify and get elected to our legislatures and help diversify us.
I don't think it will.
Okay.
The one way that you could have gender parity would be to take the 60 House members, make 30 districts, and have each district elect one male representative and one female representative. It's the pattern that we use for precinct committee people in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
It mandates equality, but and that's generally probably not a popular idea, but that's one way to actually mandate equality.
Yeah. Sarah Ferriello, you had some questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We all heard the discussion from Washington State. It seemed to me the key feature that the folks in Washington acknowledge is that you cannot take partisanship out of politics. And it seems, just in general, having heard that approach, that it makes more sense to me to just acknowledge the reality of partisanship mm-hmm. in politics and figure out a way to make the process more fair than it is to try to hold your mouth right or wink and nod and say that you're nonpartisan, but in point of fact you end up with a 2-1 vote on the issue of redistricting, and at some point in time you're back in the partisanship whether you intended to be there or not. Just like to hear the panel address that issue.
Yes, and I'm going to agree with you in that when we were lobbying for the constitutional amendment in Washington State, it was because of the extreme partisanship that showed up, and the legislature just tied itself into knots.
Yeah, not
over
like
this.
Here.
I mean, well, the Oregon is calm compared to what happened in Washington State in the 70s and 80s. And so it was to remove the process at least one step away from that highly partisanship, and thus it at least improved the process by getting a bipartisan commission. And what we didn't realize over 20 years ago is that we probably should have removed it even a little farther for the benefit of the voters. And so it is nonpartisan or apolitical of the processes you can get, I think the voters would then benefit. I think one state that goes so far as to randomly pick a bunch of registered voters for a commission, and they do the districting. And it's, that would be one extreme. I think the process that you've suggested here with the retired judges is probably about as apolitical as you can get and balanced partisan-wise without going to a totally nonpartisan commission. So that at least acknowledges that it is a partisan process, or a political process maybe is more accurate, and that it will play some role, but it shouldn't be the central role.
Actually, we have two versions. One is retired judges on the panel, the other is an appointed panel appointed by leadership of both House and Senate and others. So, I mean, we're looking at a couple of different configurations.
Mm-hmm.
Can I share a follow-up question?
Sure.
Or there are more answers?
A number of years ago, former Attorney General Dave Frohnmayer, when he was in the legislature, suggested going even further with the random drawing and said that you could draw the legislature by randomly picking them from the phone book. So that would alleviate some of the problems of redistricting.
Under the theory that you could hardly do worse. Always depended upon the kindness of total strangers.
That wasn't ever really seriously considered. I think it was a matter of levity for the committee, but not a serious proposal.
The one of the comments is that the commission should be incumbent blind. Now, I certainly do understand that, you know, the business of the commission isn't to protect incumbency, nor is it to overturn incumbency. What say you to a situation where you have district maps where the incumbent is across the street from the old district?
Using modern computers and demographic data and historic voting data, you can tailor districts to a gnat's eyebrow of any result that you want. Because of this, it begins to look like public officials are choosing their voters rather than the voters choosing their public officials. And so you want to have a system of either ignoring all that kind of data totally, including all the historic voting data and incumbent addresses and addresses of any potential candidates, maybe, not maybe, but for sure, or you go to the other extreme and you allow that information to be considered, but for the purpose of creating as many competitive districts as possible. The trouble is, I don't know how to define what competitive means. I can sort of see it just like pornography. I know what when I see it, but I couldn't tell you how to define it in any sort of mathematical way. So either you go totally in one direction and don't consider any of that kind of information, the panel, or the other extreme, and make it for the purpose of creating as many competitive districts as possible for the benefit of the voters.
We have 30 seats in the Senate. I could make a pretty good case that 10 of those or competitive seats is a third, a pretty good proportion, given the sort of diversity of Oregon in terms of urban-rural.
a third seats being competitive?
I think you need to look at competitiveness on two dimensions. One is the number of seats that are competitive, and then the number of seats that are uncompetitive one direction and uncompetitive the other direction. So
well,
that
I would argue 10 or these seats.
You might have a Senate that's 10-10-10.
Right.
And that would be, I would think, a very good measure of competitiveness. If you had it to 10 competitive districts and 20 and 0, that wouldn't be very competitive.
Yeah,
so you have to
90s.
You have to look at the different. you draw a line in the middle that says, you know, from here to here, this range of voter registration or voter history or whatever kind of combination you want to create a competitiveness scale on, that any district that falls within a certain number, 55, 45, you know, some kind of a set of numbers, then you could say, okay, of the 30 Senate districts, there are 10 that fall in that middle ground, 10 that fall on one side, 10 that fall on the other. That, I think, is a pretty easily understood measure of competitiveness.
There's a complication for that equation. What if 15 of those seats are within a 40-mile radius?
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, representative government can't help it that people live packed in, and that's just kind of how it is. I think I'd like to see us consider what I call democracy bills in a group and address one of the problems that one of our earlier speakers brought up about the low turnout in the primaries, and thus we don't get a representative candidate running. And I think from my mind's eye, that's what I see as one of our really significant problems here. And if so, we work on that in conjunction with the redistricting process, and I don't have an answer for that. But I think that is a very real problem. And so we have a multifaceted dysfunctional family here, and we have to do interventions on more than one level, I believe.
Madam Chairman, we moved away from the question of incumbent blindness. I never really did get any. I mean, if you have the relative tools to be so specific as to GPS and precinct maps down to the NAT's anatomy, and I'm not sure which part of the NAT you referred to, how is it that people would believe in any sense that an incumbent that ends up across the street from the district boundary, that wasn't intentional? How would you ever convince the incumbent, for instance, that they weren't districted out of that district by the width of a street intentionally?
Former Representative Tom Novick.
Or,
I don't think you would.
Or Representative Atkinson.
The blindness is a very troubling issue, I think. You can't mandate that people not know something. If there is a prohibition on using certain amounts of certain kinds of data in the official figurings, each member of the commission knows the area they live in, knows the kind of territory, and a certain part of the state, maybe it's only in a limited area, but they can't help but know something about the politics of their own area. So to try and mandate blindness, I think, is going the wrong direction. I think it's far wiser to simply acknowledge that information exists. And even if the commission doesn't have information, people outside the commission will be doing exactly that and then making suggestions to the commission without talking about the particulars, but saying, well, this one we think looks nice. This one's is shaped well. And the understanding is that it has a partisan underlay to it that is not on the table to be seen and discussed. That, I think that's why the blindness issue troubles me.
Me too.
So, Senator Ferrioli, I think you certainly can't tell if somebody knows something or not, but you can say that you should not consider this in drawing the boundaries.
Actually, I think when you're drawing a straight line and then you get this little bit.
It becomes obvious when a consideration like that has been made, or at least you can infer when there's a little blip on the end of a straight line that something has been going on there.
So the last question, Madam Chair.
There's one more factor on the incumbents, and that was in the 1971 redistricting. We were going from multi-member districts to single-member districts, and it happened that in Lane County, which elected, I think, seven representatives countywide, it turned out that five of the seven lived within a few blocks in one neighborhood in Eugene. So then when the single-member districting came along, it was quite a shuffle, and several of the incumbents were left out because they happened to live in the same neighborhood. Mm. So it that was the transitional problem, because once you have districts, the single-member districts, then there is a greater scattering of incumbents. But in the pre-single-member districts, we had concentrations of incumbents.
Hmm. And this last chairman is about, our question is about community of interest. Now, I can define those communities of interest pretty easily. There's people that like wolves and people that don't like wolves. And I know where the people that don't like wolves live. And then you can do socioeconomic definitions, and you can do age, and all sorts of different declinations and conjugations of community of interest. What is it?
Communities of interest have never stopped the partisan redistricting gerrymanders that have created the problem. So community of interest is, of course, so vague and in the eye of the beholder that it is a virtually meaningless concept. And it's usually used to simply justify one's otherwise unarguable arguments that would say, well, instead of saying this has a good partisan flavor for my advantage, it has a good community of interest.
I can give you a really good example. In the 90s, my Senate district had Selwood and then the West Portland Hills. There was no connection, and I know Senator Burdick didn't ever come over across the river, and redistricting that changed, and now Selwood is part of my inner Milwaukee beside Portland district. That totally makes sense. You've got neighborhood associations. I mean, there's a number of things that connect Selwood more to the rest of the Senate district than it certainly was ever connected to West Portland.
The community of interest is also kind of caught up in the order in which districts are drawn. If you start from one side of the state, you come to the point where the variables are a lot less flexible. So depending on how you start the redistricting, at some point you come to the final corner where things are kind of painted into a particular pattern, and it's a little hard to do it everywhere equally to follow the communities of interest.
In District 30, the Dalles, Wasco County, has a direct interest with the folks living in Jordan Valley on the Nevada-Idaho border. That's a community of interest by the statute.
If I could add something to this.
Briefly, yes.
Thank you. There's a hierarchy of criteria that should be applied, and there's at the top of the hierarchy is that the must-have is the equal population. And in the middle is geographic boundaries, which I think is missing from the list in this bill, where you don't want to be having districts cross mountain ranges or maybe freeways or districts.
They haven't been to mine.
Yeah. To the extent possible, it's usually phrased.
Well, somebody in Oregon's going to have. There's going to be a couple of big districts in Oregon, no matter what system you approach.
Okay,
I just would argue that, you know, some folks in your district have a lot more in common than, for example, you know, some of my folks living on the east side versus the west side. I mean, I just, you know, in terms of economics and transportation systems and all that kind of stuff, I'm very hugely different within the city of Portland. So
neighborhoods in Portland are divided by freeways, and they don't talk to each other.
Right.
And so down at the bottom of this list of the hierarchy is probably a community of interest, where it would be nice if you if people self-identified with each other, that then they would be in the same district.
Ms. Miller.
Chair Brown. Senator Farioli, thank you very much. Welcome to my world. These two, yes, they often get into it. As you can see, we don't have it.
Ask them to step in the hallway.
Yeah. I've done so before. Thank you very much for having this hearing.
For the record, I just went down the Senate races, and my guess is that we have 12, maybe 13. I might put Westland in that category of very competitive Senate districts.
If I may, Chair Brown, I have one more comment to make. That is my a lot of my motivation for wanting to see some sort of redistricting is the fallout on the Secretary of State's office. As you know, our business is election law largely, and we have not been able to even get a minor housekeeping bill passed in some sessions because there is a pushback on decisions that were made in the last redistricting. So in any way that we could depoliticize it as much as possible so that we really care about structure items, and I think you all can see how important they are to what happens here. So if we can get it away from that pressure on the Secretary of State's office, and the Secretary of State won't always be a Democrat.
Right. Thank you.
Well, those names,
and even when they are Democrats, it doesn't necessarily mean that Democrats benefit. So
I think those are natural consequences, Madam Chair.
Last but not least, thank you all very much. We appreciate it. Mr. Miller, you want to share with us your wisdom? Other than you don't want either of these bills.
Thank you, Chair Brown. Good afternoon, Senator Farioli. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm an assistant staff counsel with the Office of the State Court Administrator here this afternoon on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department on both SJR 32 and 33. Sad to report that I'm not academic enough for this discussion, but I have a different, more of a practical matter that I'd like to present for your consideration, and that revolves around the pool of 24. Our concern is that both of these measures change the Constitution and put into the Constitution a requirement on the Supreme Court that they create this pool of 24 retired judges. Our concern is that it may be difficult to create a pool at large for two reasons. One is that the group of retired judges that we draw from is fairly small, and the second reason is that there are several requirements in both measures. There are several requirements in both measures that would really winnow down, or could winnow down, the number of judges that could be eligible to be a special master. In that regard, it may be worth considering whether to not have a number placed in there or have some sort of safety valve in case the number of can't be reached.
Do you think it poses, I know judges are supposed to be non-political, but a problem for judges if they know they're going to be tied up in redistricting? Do you believe that will have any impact on their opinions or their ability to settle cases?
Madam Chair, this would only apply to the retired judges, and unless you get into the Plan B judges, they won't be settling cases or working cases. They're simply retired men and women out in the community.
Right, but if they're mediating or doing some, I mean, I know, for example, former Justice Betty Roberts is still mediating. Does she go in the pool then?
I believe she would, Madam Chair.
Okay.
But, you know, judges are very good at, in general, at putting aside and realizing that they need to be neutral on things. They have all sorts of issues like that come up when they're on the bench.
I was just saying to committee administrator, I think one of the issues is, do you have retired judges or not? And, you know, how do you force retired people to come back and serve the state of Oregon? Is it a, you know, part of their retirement service? I mean, I don't know how you do that. For some of these folks, it would be a pretty extensive commitment. Do you pay them per diem? I mean, those are some of the issues that you'd want to tackle.
Andrew.
Senator Ringo.
A lot of retired judges are making some good money by being arbitrators or mediators.
Totally.
And so, it would certainly be taking away from other financial opportunities.
Right.
I wondered whether this is a point Senator Farioli had made about whether there should be some requirement for geographical distribution in the pool of judges. You know, I know in other contexts you must have somebody from each congressional district. I don't know if that makes sense or not.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I think the only problem that arises with that is you put another qualification that the pool must meet and shrink it down all the further.
That's right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great, thank you.
Appreciate your time. Close the public hearing, SJR 32 and SJR 33. Committee be at ease till we have a third member in order to allow us for one of our hopefully last few bill introductions.
Bill introduction.
The chair would move for legislative counsel for drafting as well as introduction by the Senate Rules Committee a bill that would address recent case law related to kidnapping and cases of domestic violence. This was brought to me by a woman from the Oregon District Attorneys Association. A case just came down, and they would like a bill to address the issue. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Any further business to come before the committee? Hearing and seeing none, ordered. Thank you all very much.